UK Wine Show, show number 148, LiveX with James Miles. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 148 for the 20th of March 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's wine show, we're talking with James Miles from LiveX. We talk with James about LiveX, who trades in wines, what sort of wines they trade, and in these difficult times, we talk to him about credit risk and how they keep themselves protected from customers defaulting. In the spotlight, we're back looking at wine and food matching. This week, we're looking at desserts and wine. And since we're talking about fine wines, this week's quote is a wee bit of fun. Here it goes. I know I don't have his looks. I know I don't have his money. I know I don't have his connections, his knowledge of fine wines. I know sometimes when I eat, I get this clicking sound in my jaw. Who said that? Clues throughout the show? Answer at the end. But next up we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The wine movie Bottle Shock opens in cinemas in the UK on the 20th of March, starring Alan Rickman as Stephen Spurrier, the man who found fame for organising the Judgment in Paris tasting. The wine tasting pitched the highly regarded wines of Bordeaux and Burgundy against their Californian counterparts and was instrumental in bringing new world wines to the attention of the world.
Well, Bottle Shock's out today, but it doesn't seem to have very good distribution. I had a look around the cinemas to see who was showing it, and Odeon are the only people I could find who were showing it, but they only seem to be showing it in Manchester, of all places. So I couldn't really find it anywhere else. If you recall, Bottle Shock is about ranking Bordeaux wines against US wines, but the big controversy at the moment is the Saint-Emilion classification system. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, Chris, the French Court of Appeal has ruled that the 2006 Saint-Emilion classification will be scrapped. For those of you following the story, the Saint-Emilion classification was created in 1954 and is reviewed every 10 years. But the court judged in 2008 that there were irregularities in the tasting process in the 2006 review and that the 2006 classification should no longer stand. 8 promoted properties appealed this judgment, along with the Saint-Emilion Wine Board and the INAO, but this week it's been ruled that it definitely will be scrapped. It's good news, of course, for the demoted properties, such as Chateau La Marzelle, which was declassified in 2006. The system will remain for the 2009 vintage, but a new classification would need to be introduced.
Not much longer to go in that bun fight. I suppose it goes to show that vested interest and lots of money mean lawyers are the ones who'll do well. Perhaps the 1855 Bordeaux classification based on price might be one of the better measures of doing it. Ultimately, it measures demand, but not necessarily the quality of the wines. But at least it doesn't require the tasting skills of locals with vested interest in their wines. High prices for Bordeaux wine is one end of the market. At the bottom end, a small group of doctors are trying to crank up the minimum pricing in the UK. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, following on from the Scottish Government's plans to impose a minimum price on alcohol, there was a recommendation by UK Chief Medical Officer Sir Liam Donaldson to do the same and impose a price of 50p per unit on alcoholic drinks in England and Wales. But this has been rejected by Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Planned fixed prices would have resulted in the average bottle of wine costing a minimum of £5.05, a big increase on the current average price of £4.01. The Prime Minister said they did not want the responsible, sensible majority of moderate drinkers to have to pay more or to suffer as a result of the excesses of a small minority. But elsewhere in the world, there is support for minimum pricing strategies. The Australian Medical Association, the AMA, argues that a similar scheme in Australia, which would increase the price of alcohol, would make teenagers less able to afford the drinks and would also benefit the health of the wider population. The AMA is in favour of volumetric taxation across all drinks as part of a strategy of education and labelling, signage and restrictions on alcohol marketing. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories on our website 3050.co.uk.
As I said a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about minimum pricing, I'm actually in favour of minimum pricing. I've lived in a number of countries that have far more restrictive laws than the UK, and it's not bothered me much. I think minimum pricing is good at targeting mainly supermarkets who sell wine very cheaply. And they've shown through reckless use of alcohol as a loss leader that they can't be trusted to self-police. 50p a unit I think is a bit high, and while I don't care for wines under about £5, I think £4 is a more sensible level. I'd much rather have that than a huge duty increase which doesn't target the irresponsible supermarkets but affects the whole industry. Minimum pricing targets the supermarkets. And you can see why the lobby groups that we've spoken to in the last couple of weeks have a vested interest, because they're all being funded by large players who sell all their wine through the supermarkets. I think small independent wine merchants would do well out of minimum pricing. That's my rant for the day. Next up, we have the spotlight on dessert wines. So here we go. Now, dessert wines have a huge range of weights and flavours, and it's difficult to come up with a general rules about dessert wines other than these. Dessert wines should be sweet or sweeter than the dessert, and you need to match the weight and the flavours with the food. As a result, I think the best I can do is give you some examples of foods and wines that I think match and why. So let's start off with dark chocolate. Now, chocolate is fantastic, and often they're very sweet, although chocolate doesn't need to be sweet. Good quality stuff can be a wee bit bitter, and it can often have a fruity note to it. This, along with sweet flavours, means that red wine is often a good mix. Consider a fruity port, but not tawny port, Banyuls, sweet Madeira wines such as Malmsey and Bale. And if the chocolate's not very sweet and very high in cocoa solids, so 65% or higher, then you can probably match it to a really rich Barossa Shiraz or perhaps even a Zinfandel. Next one is ice cream. Now, ice cream comes in a multitude of flavours, but they all have the same characteristic of being cold and high in fat. The best match I've come across so far is aged Pedro Ximénez sherries, either with simple vanilla ice cream or quite nice if you actually drizzle it over the top of your ice cream. It's actually very, very delicious. Pastries. Now, flaky pastries that are light can be complemented with a sweet Italian wine such as a Moscato d'Asti, which, as an aside, is absolutely excellent for hot curry dishes. Spicy fruit-filled pastries, such as those that have got marmalade in them, need a more pungent dessert wine, and perhaps a Moscato-based sweet wine would be best here. Now, there's a range of desserts you can have, but I want to just give you a quick idea of some of the main types of dessert wines to consider. Let's start off with late harvest. Late harvest wines are made from grapes that are left on the vine. Sugars increase, but acidity as the grapes ripen will decrease and can fall dangerously low. Next one is ice wine. If the wine's left on the vine and the grapes freeze, when the grapes are crushed, the water crystals can be easily removed, concentrating both the sugar, acids, and flavour. Now, Canadian ice wine and German Eichwein are excellent examples for this. Noble rot wines, or Botrytis, are wines infected with the fungi Botrytis cinerea, or just often called Botrytis wines. The fungus sucks the moisture out of the grapes, concentrating the remaining juices, sugars, and acids. Examples of this are Sauternes, Barsac, and Tokaj Azu, all have a bit of Botrytis in them. Dried grapes are a sweet wine a lot of people forget about, but after picking, grapes can be dried. That reduces the water levels in the wine, increasing the sugars and acid concentration. Trouble is, drying tends to oxidize the wines, so you'll tend to lose any delicate fresh fruit flavors. Examples of this include Vinsanto, Ricciato del Valpolicella, and Ricciato di Suave. Fortified wines is obviously the last type of sweet wines you can get, and they're made by adding spirit to fermented juice after fermentation or during fermentation. As yeast converts the sugar to alcohol, if you pour in some spirit, it'll raise the alcohol level, killing off the yeast and fortifying the wine, but what you're left is very sweet, very alcoholic wines. Wines made to this method include sherries, port, Banyuls, and Madeiras. That ends our look at desserts and dessert wines. Next week in the Spotlight, we're going to review the movie Bottle Shock, fresh out in the UK today. Speaking of movies, this week's quote is from a movie. I know I don't like to have his looks. I know I don't have his money. I know I don't have his connections, his knowledge of fine wines. I know sometimes when I eat, I get this clicking sound in my jaw. Now, it was said in an excellent comic movie about two guys who produce a TV show in their parents' basement. Schwing is the line from the movie, But probably the most famous line is, party on. Or perhaps, excuse me, a baking powder? As next up, we have a bloke who knows a lot about the price of fine wines. So next up, let's have a talk to James Miles from LiveX. Hi, I'm here with James Miles from LiveX. How are you, James?
Good.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about LiveX and a wee bit about how you guys make your money. Do you want to tell us a wee bit about yourself first, James? Are you a wine man or...?
Well, funnily enough, I'm not. I'm not a wine man. We started LiveX in 2000, but prior to that, I was a stockbroker. And we had this slightly crazy idea that we could build a marketplace for fine wine. And not surprisingly, we based that around the stock market model because that's what we knew and that's what we understood.
We were talking earlier and you were talking about different competitors when you first started out. A lot of them were looking to try and take out the middleman, really. But you seem to be almost embracing the middleman. What's going on there?
Well, sure, we were a bit different, that's true, because the conventional wisdom at the time, we set up in the sort of teeth of the dot-com boom, was that the secret, the great strength of the internet would be disintermediating the middleman. There were a lot of people setting up exchanges involved in the fine wine area when we started, but we took a different approach. We took the view that actually the middleman would remain absolutely crucial in the fine wine market, largely because, having come from a financial background, we were aware that we had been trading stocks and we were aware that other commodities were traded electronically and had been for some period of time. And the middleman simply wasn't going out of business. So our idea was slightly from a different angle. We took the view that fine wine was traded as a commodity, and therefore we felt that an exchange could add a lot of value to the existing marketplace in terms of improving efficiency and adding transparency. And I think that that's largely been proven to be correct.
A lot of people would say that fine wine isn't a commodity. It's a luxurious piece of art. You're a commodity man.
Sure. I think it's true. There is a view that wine is for drinking and not for speculating. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to that view. But actually, it's a bit like saying houses are for living in, or copper is for making into electrical wiring, or something like that. That these things are all true. But ultimately, we operate in a free market. And the only way to really ration a scarce commodity in a free market is through price, and therefore there is a market. Speculation has always played a part in the fine wine market, and I think it always will do, you know, unless we decide that the best way to ration wine is to give everyone a thimble. It's always going to be rationed through price. So within that context, there'll always be a marketplace, and our role is merely as a facilitator in that process, to oil the wheels and to make it more convenient, more efficient for the participants in that marketplace to trade.
How do you guys make your money then? Is it through just selling wine and buying wine? You're not brokers yourself?
We're not. We don't own a single bottle of wine.
I bet you do at home.
we do get tempted. This is definitely true. We probably do have more wine than we need personally. No, we purely just take a commission on the way through. Like most exchanges, what LiveX is at its heart is a big database of prices. When people talk about exchanges, they're really talking about exchanges of information. And really, that's our business. Data is LiveX's business, probably more than wine, which is sometimes difficult for some people to get their heads around. But clearly, one of the ways that we make money from our database is by putting a buyer and seller in contact with each other. And for that, we take a commission.
What's the commission?
We charge 2-3% each side. And then we also...
So it's the buyer and the seller.
To the buyer and the seller, that's right.
And can I go on your exchange and buy some wine or sell some wine?
Well, you could only do that through one of our merchant members, because LiveX is, as I said earlier, is only an exchange for middlemen. So all of our customers are merchants or professional traders of one kind or another. So The simple answer to that is no, not directly. The only way you could actually trade on LiveX would be through one of our merchant members, so it would be indirectly, and you'd have to pay them a fee. And as far as LiveX is concerned, our customer or our counterparty in any transaction that you did would be with our merchant member and not with you directly.
Oh, it's a shame. What sort of volume do you put through the exchange? Is it, you know, £1,000 a week or?
Well, we try to do £1 million a week. That's what we're set up to do. And you know, we've seen substantial growth over the last 5 or 10 years, particularly as the technology has got better and better. And I mean, interestingly, even though we started off as a dot-com business, it's only really in the last 2 to 3 years that we've done a substantial amount of business online. Initially, at least 90% of our business was transacted over the or agreed on the telephone and then put through online once everything had been agreed. From 2 or 3 years ago, that 10% has increased to about 70% today. So that does give you an indication of just how much the internet has improved over that period of time, over the 8 years or so that we've been in business.
Sure. So about 70% of your work is commission-based, is it?
Yes. Yeah, so we generate about 70-75% of our income from commissions, and the balance from subscriptions. Our merchant members pay a membership fee to be a member of LiveX and to use the information that we publish. And we also sell data feeds to mostly, again, to merchants or professional traders. And so data and subscriptions is about 20-25% of our business. And then the balance of about 5%, we've got a small freight forwarding and storage straight warehouse services business that does a lot of stock checking and verification work for overseas merchants and wine funds. And we also organize transport all over the world. And also long-term storage.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. What sort of wines do you deal with? Well, I suppose it is fine wines, but you know, there's lots of fine wines in the world. Where's your volume coming from?
Well, one of the great ironies of the fine wine market is, or the wine market in general, is that it's an incredibly fragmented market. I think we've got 99,000 different commodities listed on our platform. But the vast bulk of our business is actually in relatively few wines. I think last year, around 50% of our business was in the first growth, so in just five brands. Mm-hmm. So yes, while the fine wine market is very, very fragmented, in business terms or in economic terms, the fine wine market is very, very concentrated in relatively few names.
Okay, what about other countries? Like Burgundy's quite, you know, got a reasonable fine wine, but it is... It's a bit fragmented, you say, because of those Napoleonic rules and all that
sort
of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we do try to do business. The issue really is that Bordeaux is 90% of our business, largely because if you're looking at the high-value wines in the world in which we concentrate, Bordeaux just makes those kinds of wines in much, much bigger volumes. If the average price for a first growth is £3,000 to £4,000, at that price bracket, anywhere else, in any other region or anywhere else in the world, the producers are going to be making wines at that price level in very, very small quantities and not in the sort of 10 to 20,000 type volumes that the first growths are making them in.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. So you need both a lot of product and a high price in that product to make it worthwhile for the transactions.
Absolutely. It's all about price times volume, and hence the economics, when you come to look at your add up your turnover at the end of the year, it's very, very Bordeaux and very, very first growth orientated.
Of the other regions, what are the main two or three different producers or regions that really stand out?
The main ones are the classic fine wine regions. Burgundy would be perhaps 2-3% of our business. Champagne would be about the same. Rhone would be about 0.5%, and Italy might be 2-3%, and the balance would be concentrated in New World wines and Spain, you know, things like Penfolds Grange in Australia, a small amount of things like Opus One, possibly Screaming Eagle in the States. And then in Burgundy, it would be very heavily concentrated in Domaine Romani Conti, but also the other top names like Vogue or Le Flave or Lafon, those sort of very, very high value and sought after sought after names.
Obviously, you've got two people constructing the deal, and you're just saying, this guy wants to buy it and at that price, this person wants to sell it at that price, give me my commission. But there's more to that than that. There's a lot of credit issues associated with selling and trading. I used to do a bit of energy trading a long time ago, and you know, managing credit risk, particularly at this stage in the sort of economic cycle, is quite important. Do your suppliers or purchasers have to take out insurance against the other person, or what's going on there?
Well, the risk is managed by ourselves because actually LiveX is an anonymous platform. I mean, that's one of the discretion is one of the key bits of value that we add. So the buyer and the seller actually are never introduced to each other on LiveX. So the risk side of things is really managed by us, and it's something clearly that we watch very, very carefully. It's absolutely essential to the smooth running of our marketplace. And as a default position, we actually don't give any credit to anybody. In the instances where people ask for it, we go out and we seek an insured limit. Our buyers are basically insured by credit insurance. Any credit limits on LiveX are set at a strictly arm's length basis by the credit insurer, who's ultimately taking the risk. And we also try to mitigate our risk by vetting members of LiveX extremely carefully. And any new member of LiveX has to be approved by our membership committee. And before even presenting a customer to the membership committee, we will credit check them, we'll take trade references. So we try very, very hard, obviously, to minimize our risk. And it's proved to be pretty successful so far, touch wood. But clearly, the current environment will no doubt prove to be quite testing.
Does the person not release the wine until the other person's been paid, or what's the actual mechanism for transactions to go through?
Well, we have a standard contract on LiveX which determines the condition that the wines must be received by LiveX. So we've got our own warehouse facility, and the vast majority of the cases that come through us are checked, photographed, to make sure that they're in satisfactory condition. The seller basically is obliged to deliver goods to us within 14 days.
Oh, okay. So the seller sells the wine, gives it to you. When you receive the goods, you verify that they're in a good condition.
Yes. The buyer is obligated to pay us within 14 days of month end. In most cases, once we receive the money, we will pay that money to the seller. And we will we'll then release the goods to the buyer. But we're actually, you know, it's in fact all about minimizing our risk. You know, actually the buyer and the seller's counterparty is us. And the way that we manage our business means that we are very liquid in the sense that we're not holding any stock. So all of our assets and liabilities are matched back to back so that we have very good cash flow, and we've always maintained a very strong and very liquid balance sheet so that we can look anybody in the eye and say that we're in a good position to be able to settle any trade that enter into with us on LiveX.
Okay, so you're effectively... Do people take out credit risk against you then?
They could easily do that. They could easily do that, yes. I mean, you know, that's really up to them to do that. We take the view that settling and clearing trades or handling the stock and the payment efficiently is a strong part of why people use LiveX, because there is a sense that there's a high level of assurance that you will get paid and the stock that you get will arrive on time and will be in the kind of condition that you were hoping it would turn up in.
What about fraud? If I was a member of LiveX and I just happened to have purchased some time in the future a dodgy bottle of Chateau Margaux, or a case of Chateau Margaux, and it just happened that I purchased it was fraudulent when I purchased it, and I sell it, and my counterparty says this is fraudulent. What's the comeback?
Well, then? You know, I mean, I can't think of a single instance where that's happened over 8 years. But if that did happen, we would return the bottle in question or the case in question to the supplier, and I think it's highly likely that the supplier would replace that, because failing to replace it would no doubt damage their reputation. And the thing that really binds LiveX together is the fact that everyone who uses it has a reputation, and they need to trade in the market tomorrow and the next day. So walking away from any transaction is a decision that no one's going to take lightly, because there's no doubt that their reputation would struggle to recover from such a...
Not with another counterparty, because no other counterparty knows who they are. It's their reputation with you.
Yes, absolutely.
So would you ban them from LiveX?
I think we'd have to look at that on a case-by-case, case-by-case situation.
Because it does
I think, you know, if someone sold a fraudulent bottle of... or a fraudulent case of wine and wasn't prepared to... I mean, I can't think of an instance where they wouldn't.
There's lots of cases, though. Like, there's one in New York where a German supplier is being taken to court by an American for supplying fraudulent wine. And the case is... the argument is whether it's fraudulent or not in the first place, let alone whether... Quite. So there is lots of wiggle room for everybody, really.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think fraud has been a problem in the wine business. No doubt it will be again. It's been a problem in all businesses.
And it's quite a bit different from a ton of copper, though, because a ton of copper is a ton of copper.
Yes, I mean, I think there have been instances of fake warrants and fake certificates and that sort of thing in all markets. I think, you know, that wherever there's money involved, there's always a danger that there are going to be crooks too. So this is something that everyone in the trade tries very hard to police, and we're very vigilant about it. In most of the instances, though, you know, we're trading in relatively young wines where the provenance is typically pretty quickly tracked straight back to the chateau. So we haven't found it to be a big problem, but it is a risk that everyone in the wine trade has to live with and to deal with. But it is part and parcel of doing business in our trade.
Okay, then, James, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Great.
I thought the breakdown of wines trade in Bordeaux was really interesting. It just goes to show that some of the reasons for so much hype about Bordeaux wines is because there is a lot of it about. It seems funny that even scarcer wines may not appreciate as much in value because they're just not traded. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to be staying with LiveX. Next week, we're going to be talking with James about on-premier campaigns in the last 8 years or so since LiveX started, and what's going to happen with the wines from the 2008 campaign. And the week after that, we're going to be talking about LiveX's indices and trading derivatives on wine. But before we finish up, let's have the quote. I know I don't have his looks. I know I don't have his money. I know I don't have his connections, his knowledge of fine wines. I know sometimes when I eat, I get this clicking sound in my jaw. Well, any ideas who said it? Well, it was said by Wayne Campbell in Wayne's World, party on. Until next week, cheers and good drinking. And party on.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.